streaming on Paramount Plus.
You ready, Bob?
Well, all right.
Audiences are raving. Bob Marley is electrifying. It's the feel-good movie of the year.
You dig?
Bob Marley, One Love. Rated PG-13. Now streaming on Paramount Plus.
Showtime Sports presents Showtime Boxing with Eric Raskin and Kieran Mulvaney.
Hello and welcome to another edition of Showtime Boxing with Raskin and Mulvaney. With my co-host Eric Raskin, I am Kieran Mulvaney. Eric, I like to think we do an okay job with this podcast, you know. It's not exactly Edward R. Murrow journalism, but we do a serviceable job.
Sure.
Keeping people informed and possibly entertained. Honestly, between you and me, well, and I guess everybody who's listening, I'm pretty pleased with the job we've done of remembering Marvin Hagler over the last couple of weeks. Unfortunately, I haven't told you this before, this is actually really crushing to me. I just heard from an acquaintance, actually, of the Marvelous One, that it turns out that our fondness for the middleweight champion wasn't reciprocated. Not long, actually, before he passed away, he apparently heard an episode of the pod, and his review was simply very bad.
Yeah. He must have heard an old episode of our HBO podcast.
Probably.
Right? Nobody could possibly say that about the
probably one of the ones version. When I was gone. Probably something you did with, oh, I don't know, Al.
Yeah, could have been one of those. I could see him saying very bad to that. But yeah, no, I love that story Steve Farhood told last week about Hagler's two-word review of the magazine article he handed him. And I've started incorporating it into my everyday life, actually, making it my catchphrase. Like, if I go to the supermarket and somebody doesn't have their mask up high enough, covering their mouth and nose, I point at them and say, very bad. My son cranks his music too loud. I stick my head in his room. Give him the Hagler glare. Very bad. I get a spam call. Yeah, I used to ignore those. Now I answer the phone and just say, very bad. And by the way, during last week's interview with Barry and Steve, every single one of us said Ray Leonard won their fight. Wow, that would have gotten the ultimate very bad if Hagler were around to hear it.
Yes, absolutely. Do you really give him the Hagler stare, though? Really?
Can anyone accurately replicate the Hagler glare? And certainly not me. I'm not the intimidating sort. I give it my best shot.
There you go. That's the best you could do. All right. It is a little bit of a marking time podcast this week. It's not very bad, but there's not a tremendous amount of action to cover or to preview, actually. Later on, we will look at Dillian Whyte's one-sided fourth-round win over Alexander Povetkin and Amanda Serrano's stoppage of Daniela Bermudez. We'll look ahead to the long-awaited Jamel Herring-Carl Frampton meeting and the return of one of my favorites, Murajan Akhmadaliev. But let's kick things off in style. As we welcome an old friend of the podcast, the former junior middleweight champ, and now, of course, Showtime's ringside expert analyst, Raul El Diamante Marquez. Raul, welcome back. Thanks, as always, for joining us on the podcast.
I love the introduction. In style, and then the
there you go.
Pronunciation of El Diamante. That's,
hey, he likes that.
Hey, are you competing with Barry Tompkins? Because Barry's really good at all those Spanish names. So that's pretty good.
No one can compete with Barry Tompkins.
It's true.
Absolutely. There's only one Barry Tompkins. You're right. That's right. You're right.
Okay. So first of all, you are joining us from, I think, it's Shreveport, Louisiana, right now. Tell us why you're there and what's happening.
Well, I'm here because my son, Giovanni, you know, he's a competitor in amateur boxing, and we're here in the Nationals. They were supposed to happen in December because of the pandemic and all that. Early December, they got postponed. And then, of course, my son did catch, you know, being young and being out there, you know, he did catch the virus in early January. But, you know, he recovered pretty fast and stuff. So, yeah, we had a really good camp, and you know, we're here for the Nationals, and we're excited. We're really excited. We've been to a couple of national tournaments, and he's done very well. Last year, he tried to make the Olympic team. He lost in one of the Olympic trials qualifier to the eventual guy that made the Olympic team, Deontay Johnson. Gave him a hell of a fight. It was a split decision. You know, Deontay's got a lot of experience, a lot of international experience, and Giovanni's just turned 20 years old, and he gave him a good fight. So we're really excited about this tournament. He's He's a top 10 seed. There's about, I want to say a little bit over 50 fighters, competitors in his weight class. And he's a number 9 seed. And he's also beat some of the guys ahead of him. I think about 2 or 3 guys he's beat. So, you know, we hope that we do well, you know, one fight at a time, like I tell him.
Does it feel strange to be sort of back at amateur national tournaments again? Does it bring memories back? And is it a lot more difficult being a boxing dad than being a boxer?
Well, I mean, it does bring a lot of memories. You know, it's been 32 years since 1989, since, you know, and I got to give credit to my father, Arturo, you know, who trained my son, that my dad made me a national champion in the open. Back then it was the open division. Now it's called the elite division, where age don't matter, just the weight and experience don't matter. Before that, I had won the National Junior Olympics, but it was, you know, age at 14, 15. But, yeah, it brings a lot of memories, man. You see coaches, you see judges, all kinds of people from the past that remember you or, you know, followed you, you know, followed my career. And it's a lot of pressure. I'm not going to lie. It's a lot of pressure for me. I get nervous. That's why I don't work the corner. I get really nervous with my son. Yeah. But, you know, Giovanni, he takes pressure very well, you know, because when he's going to fight, you know, people know he's my son. So they want to check him out. They want to see how good he is or how bad he is. Or, you know, there's always going to be criticism. And I worry about that. I worry that that's going to get to him. But no, he's real focused. I mean, he's real confident for this tournament. He's just that type of kid, man. And that, you know, of course, you know, me and my father, we were biggest critiques. You know, when he fights that he's lost, we tell him the truth, you lost. Or fights that he got ripped off, bad decision, we got ripped off. Or fights that were close, you did well, we tell him the truth. So, you know, I think my son, he's talented. I think he's a pretty good fighter. He thinks, you know, and, you know, we'll see how this tournament goes.
Is turning pro an option you guys are thinking about, or is that not yet?
Right now, at this point, we're focusing on this national tournament. We're trying to win the nationals and hopefully get on the national team and, you know, start traveling with the national team and competing against different countries. Of course, you know, down the line, I mean, yeah, his goal is to go professional one day. But right now, we're just focusing on this tournament and see how it goes.
And how old is he, Raul?
Giovanni just turned 20 years old.
Okay.
20 years old, yeah. He just turned 20, and he's got about, I want to say, over 60, 70 fights. He hasn't lost in a while, you know. The last time he lost was to the guy that made the Olympic team, but before that, he hadn't lost in a while. So he's doing well. He's doing pretty well.
Okay. So between, you know, following him around to tournaments and your commentary work, you're obviously a busy guy. I believe you also give private lessons in Houston. Have you ever thought about training or managing pro boxers, or are you happy with the full plate you have right now?
I got a full plate, man. I got a full plate. Yeah. You know, my oldest son, I got 5 kids. My oldest son is 28. And then I got Arturo, who's 24. And, you know, he was a professional fighter. We got him to 10-0, and I was managing them, you know. But and then we got Giovanni, and then I got remarried, got started all over again. I got 2 little ones, Liam, who's 3.5, and then I got my baby girl Alina, that's 2 years old. So I'm, you know, and then I have my gym that I run. I do private lessons, I do boxing classes when I'm in town. I run the show. Of course, I got Showtime. Then you know, my son is competitive in boxing. Liam is starting to play soccer now, so I'm pretty busy. But I don't think I have the time or the patience, I'm going to be honest with you, to be a trainer. I've worked with different people just there in the gym and you know, with private lessons, just teaching them the basics. I'm a very impatient guy. And I don't think I have the you know, it's not an easy, I mean, boxing is a tough sport, you know, and to teach just even the basics, it's difficult, you know. So, but I, you know, I was managing my son Arturo. You know, we had him with Top Rank for his first 8 fights, and then, you know, we both agreed we got to let go of the contract. You know, we just separated, being the good manager that I am, because at that point he was 8-0, and it was just, you know, some fights that they were offering me, and I don't think it was, you know, the right fights for my son at that stage of his career, which, but I understand what, you know, what Top Rank was doing at that point. So, you know, we still, he still fought two more fights. We got him at 10-0. And of course the goal was to get him on Showbox, you know, and I had talked to, you know, Gordon Hall about that, get him on Showbox, you know, once he had another two or three fights. But one of the, one of those opponents, you know, the veteran opponents, that went the distance with one of the Olympic guys. I can't recall at this point, but poked his eye, you know, poked his eye. Mm. And, you know, it was giving him problems, and it wasn't a detached retina. It was called a corneal abrasion.
Mm-hmm.
And it just, it was giving him problems, you know, so we just said, you know what, just get, you know, you don't need a box, and, you know, just,
right.
It's kind of sad for him because, and for all of us, you know, because he wanted to see how far he could go. But, you know, he's a dad now. He's got a daughter, my granddaughter, and, you know, he's married, and, you know, he's got a good job, and, you know, boxing is a tough sport, man. So we decided not to let him fight anymore. And he agreed to. So, yeah, that's where we're at.
Okay. All right. All right. Well, obviously, you mentioned Showbox, and that's where we see you most often now. And obviously, in that position, you've seen so many prospects come and go.
Yeah.
And some make it. Like you said, boxing's a tough sport. Anything can happen. Some make it, some don't.
Yeah.
It looks like one guy who looks like he's got what it takes to make it is Brandon Lee. We had him on the podcast the other week, and we were super impressed with him. I mean, obviously impressed with what he does in the ring, but really impressed with him out of the ring as well. Let's ask you what we asked Barry and Steve recently. Do you think he's got the potential to be the real deal, or are Eric and I getting a little carried away too early?
No, man. I honestly, I love the kid, and I love his dad too, Bobby. You know, me and Bobby had conversations before. He's like, man, I wish I lived in Houston, you know, so you could help us out. Because people are always sending me stuff through Facebook and social media, you know, can you help me manage my fighter or train my fighter? And I said, no, I don't do that. I just do, you know, Showtime. I do the broadcasting, and I run a boxing fitness gym. But yeah, I mean, Brandon, he's skilled. I mean, he's an aggressive fighter with heavy hands, and he's always firing back, you know, and he can hurt you at any time. And I really believe that he could be a world champion. He just needs, you know, just more experience under his belt, you know, more seasoning, you know, he needs those valuable rounds. He needs to go some, you know, good hard rounds with someone that's going to take him like 8-10 rounds, like where he's, you know, breathing hard and he's got to dig deep and really deal with some kind of adversity. Because so far, like, I mean, honestly, like everything has been pretty easy for him. And it's not his fault, you know, because his last opponent, Samuel T, a guy that had never been knocked out, and, you know, T beat some decent guys on Showbox, like Kenneth Sims, and I remember when he beat Oshaki Foster, he beat Sonny Fredrickson. That fight was on a Showbox, but he lost to Montana Love, a real difficult guy to fight, but he went the distance. And he goes out there and just puts him to sleep, man. He paralyzed him. That surprised me, you know. And we were talking, I was talking to Brandon, you know, I like the way you took your time when you heard him, and it seemed you went for the finish, but then you're like, okay, I felt like he said, okay, it looks like it's not time for him to go. He kind of took a step back, got back to the bases with a jab, and then that overhand, all of a sudden, I don't know where, bam, and just put him to sleep, man. It was beautiful. It was beautiful.
Yeah, I mean, we've, just like you, we've been waiting to see him get tested. We want him to get some rounds in. It just hasn't happened yet, but we love to see that when prospects do get tested, find out what they're made of, if they get hurt or even dropped. And one Showbox regular who went through that recently was Xavier Martinez, who was dropped twice in round 8 by Claudio Moreira. It looked like he was done, came back to win the rest of the rounds and the fight. Did your feelings about Martinez change after that fight? And if so, do you rate his chances of success as higher or lower than you did beforehand?
Not at all. That was good. That was good that it happened for Martinez. You know, at that point of his career, what, he was like 15-0 with 11 knockouts. Again, for him, everything had been relatively very easy. I mean, he had like a couple of quick knockouts on Showbox. And Martinez, he needed that kind of fight, you know, before. It was pretty easy for him. And he dealt with a lot of adversity. You know, like you said, he survived two knockdowns. That first knockdown, I thought it was over. I really felt bad for the kid because, you know, I mean, I really thought it was over. but he got back up. You know, he went past eight rounds for the first time, and he went a tough 12 rounds against Marrero. That was a real test. I mean, that guy, I believe he's, you know, he's a veteran of, I think he's got over 25 fights.
Right.
So, you know, Martinez showed he could come back, and he didn't fold. And for me, you know, I've seen a lot of young prospects in fights or even in sparring where they quit, man. They quit or they just give up. They fold, you know. And I believe that's going to make Martinez a better fighter. You know, yeah. I truly believe that. Yeah.
Did you have any fights like that early in your career? I know you got through cuts when you won the title against Stevens and certainly the fight against Keith Mullins, but you never had to get up off the deck, did you? Or am I forgetting an early fight of yours?
I never did. Not early in my career. I never did. I mean, I got dropped by Jermaine Taylor, but I knew where I was at. I got back up right away.
Right.
That was it pretty much. But I did. I mean, it was a fight. I mean, back when USA Tuesday Night Fights was around, I fought against Alex Rios, and I know Alex Rios, he was a top prospect from San Antonio, Texas. I believe he ended up fighting Quincy Taylor for the middleweight title, mm-hmm. or Julian Jackson, one of them. And he was a really power puncher. He could crack. At that point, when I fought him, I believe he was like 15-1 or something like that on USA Tuesday Night Fights, and I went in there, and I knocked him out in the first round. 1-2, you know, and then my right hook. And I put him to sleep pretty much like Sam Teeb got put to sleep the other night by Brendan Lee.
Yeah. So one guy who's left Showbox far behind, seems destined for a very bright future, is Jerome Boots Ennis. Mm-hmm. And he's taking a step up on Showtime Championship Boxing on April 10th when he faces off against Sergei Lipinets. What do you think about Lipinets as an opponent at this stage of Ennis' career? And what do you want to see from him?
Well, I believe that, you know, Lipinets, you know, he's experienced, you know, he's tough, he's durable. I mean, he's in shape. He's going to stand in front of him and he's going to come to fight. And that works perfect for Boots Ennis. I really like that fight for him. Mm-hmm. And, you know, just like any other fighter that has never been into the back half of the fight, I want to see, you know, Boots go some quality rounds where he's being pushed. And, you know, I just want to see how he thinks and adapts in difficult moments. We still haven't seen that with him. And, you know, hopefully Lipinets, because, you know, he's a veteran. He's fought some tough, durable guys. You know, Peterson, Mikey Garcia. Mm. Who else has he fought? You know, he's been in there, you know. So hopefully Lipinets will take him there. But, you know, I think highly of Ennis. I mean, I had – when we first covered Ennis, and I go way back with, you know, with his dad. We know each other from back in the amateur days. And he followed me in the amateurs. I fought some, you know, guys that he knew and stuff. So – when I first saw the kid, I mean, I was really impressed by Boots, you know, because he's highly skilled. I mean, he's a switch hitter, you know, he lefty, righty. He fights really good in the pocket, too. He's got good footwork. I mean, he's got really good reflexes. His instincts are incredible. He's got speed. I mean, he's a combination puncher. I mean, I believe the kid has it all, and I think he's – and I'm not just saying that because I know his dad, but, I think he's one of the guys that's the future of boxing. And you know, he came out of Showbox, so right. Yeah. that's even better for us. We love that. Yeah. I know Mr. Gordon Hall loves that, and everybody else Showbox loves that. Yeah.
Well, another guy who's in that conversation for possible future of boxing type guys and in that same division at welterweight is Virgil Ortiz. We saw him mm-hmm. step up against Maurice Hooker last week. Yeah, he took some shots and struggled a little bit, but he got the job done against a very good opponent. Right now, where would you rank Ortiz and Ennis relative to each other in terms of development? And can you pick one of them that you think is more likely to have a successful career than the other if you had to right now?
Yeah, I mean, look, I mean, they're both talented guys and they've been doing what they're supposed to, you know. And Ortiz, you know, he's a physical, aggressive pressure fighter that breaks you down, you know, with body shots. He's pretty consistent with his combos and he keeps a busy pace. But I just feel that, you know, he's one dimension. He fights one way, you know. And compared to Ennis, like I said, he's highly skilled. And I believe Ennis just has more dimensions to his game. And, you know, he'll give you different looks. And I just think he's a better fighter overall. And he could do more. That's just, that's what I think.
Right.
But I believe Ennis is the better fighter. And maybe down the line, you know, Ortiz could prove that wrong. I mean, right. they're on the right track. You know, there's a lot of names in that division, and maybe they'll meet down the road.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, indeed. Another young contender we had on the podcast recently was David Benavidez, you know, then a few days after we had him, we saw him stop Ronald Ellis. What's your take on him and his potential? And are you concerned about the red flags there, that he's been stripped of his title twice, you know, once for testing positive for cocaine and once for missing weight? Do you think that he's learned lessons there, or the fact that he's had these kind of transgressions a couple of times, is that a worry for you?
Paramount Plus and the National Park Foundation present A Mountain of Zen. Are you still listening? Good. Take a deep breath. You needed a break. This Earth Week, you can live stream 7 national parks for 7 days on Paramount Plus. So, yes, you can literally stream a stream. Paramount Plus, official streaming partner of the National Park Foundation.
It's the most all-star studded challenge ever. And this time, it's every competitor for themselves.
Best challenge ever!
The Challenge All-Stars. New season now streaming on Paramount Plus. Go to ParamountPlus.com to try it free. Terms apply.
Well, I mean, you got to give the kid a break. I mean, he's been, you know, he turned pro at 16, I believe, and he was playing in Mexico. And then he became a champion at age 20. Right. And, you know, we all make mistakes. You know, especially at that age. I mean, you know, for the Ellis, Ronald Ellis fight, I mean, he got himself ready. You know, he had like a 3-month camp. I think he was in Big Bear for 2 months. Before that, he was training in Seattle, Washington, where he trains, you know, and I believe, you know, he changed his diet. I know the week of the fight, when he got to the Mojica Casino, he was already on weight. Mm-hmm. And I think he's matured. You know, he's showing a lot of maturity. Plus, you know, he's a father now. I mean, if you don't mature when you become a father, then something is wrong. But, you know, he just needs, now that, yeah, he did it one time, he just needs to be consistent, you know, stay in the gym, you know, just train in between fights, watch his eating habits, and just be a professional 24/7.
Yep.
And I know that he knows that he's in a division, 168, that has a lot of big names on there, a lot of names. And, you know, we all know that he wants to fight the king of the super promoted division, and you know, of course, that's Canelo Alvarez, so he knows what's at stake.
You know, you mentioned like there's great names in and around that division, and the couple that are mentioned, particularly in the context of possible opponents of Benavidez and possible opponents for Canelo, Caleb Plant, Jamal Charlo's down at 160, but could probably easily make 168. How do you sort of see those three, Plant and Charlo and Benavidez, relative to each other? And if you had to pick one to give Canelo at least a tough fight or maybe upset him, which would you pick?
I mean, I think, honestly, guys, I think Caleb Plant, Charlo moving up to 168, because I know he talked about moving 8 pounds. They all know that they have to fight each other one way or another to get the big name. You know, they want Canelo. That's the big money. I can't really pick. You know, I think they each are talented in their own kind of way. But, you know, since we're talking about Benavidez, I think he's definitely an aggressive combination punching machine. You know, he throws a lot of punches. I just think he needs more strength, you know, strength up more, get more power in his shot, because he throws a lot of combinations. He keeps the busy pace. But either one of those guys that you named, David Benavidez, Caleb Plant, Charlo, maybe they need to fight each other, you know, and whoever wins when they fight each other, whoever wins deserves a fight against Canelo, because at the end of the day, Canelo, I mean, he is the star, and he's gonna fight who he wants to fight.
Yeah.
So I look at it that way.
Right. Yeah. All right. Well, we can't let you go, Raul, without asking you about one of this week's biggest breaking news stories. Your old Olympic roommate, Oscar De La Hoya, announced this week that at age 48, he will return to the ring on July 3rd, opponent to be determined. He hasn't fought in more than 12 years. He's floated comeback talk a couple of times before this, and Kieran and I hadn't taken it very seriously prior to now. You know, Oscar.
Yeah.
Do you think this is serious and it'll happen? And as long as I'm asking you about Oscar, what about you? Would you ever consider joining this comeback circuit that's going on?
I was going to say, when you told me he was coming back, I was going to say, so I guess he's giving me 4 months to get ready for the fight. You know?
There you go.
I'll be ready.
Nice.
Okay. Wait, April, May, June, July. I stay in the gym, you know, we just got to come up with a weight. You know, I know he's talking about 165. I don't know if you guys, I've challenged Oscar plenty of times. But the first time that he talked about coming back, I even tagged him on the video on Twitter and whatever, you know, social media. I challenged him plenty of times on different podcasts too, and I'm challenging him again on your podcast. that's the only fight, of course. That's the only fight that I would come back for, because, you know, I have my reasons. You know, back when I was champion and we were both fighting for top rank, and of course I fought on a couple of Oscars big pay-per-view events. And I know at one point that was Top Rank's goal. That was Bob Ren's goal, to match me and him together, because, you know, promotion was already there. We were Olympic roommates, and now we meet in the ring, you know, so we're still promoted that way. You know, we're Olympic roommates, and then we meet in the ring 35 years later, or whatever years it is, you know, 36 right. years late, whatever, after the Olympics.
I guess about 28
years
later. 28. That 26, sounds right. Yeah.
Yeah, 20, yeah. 28, 28. Right. There we go. 28 years later, and I would love that. I would love that. I mean, he was my Olympic roommate. And not only that, he was my roommate all through, like, when we're on the national team. I got on the national team in 1989. Oscar didn't come on the scene until, I believe, late 90, early 91. And, you know, we traveled all over the world together. Competed against different countries, you know, Italy, in Australia, Germany, just, you know, all over the States. We were always together.
So is there any personal dislike between you and Oscar?
I don't know. You know, I don't talk to him, obviously. You know, I don't, you know, I haven't seen him in years. Mm-hmm. I don't think it's any personal dislike. I mean, we were good friends back then, and I don't know what happened. You know, just things fell out, and all I know is that, you know, when we're in the, you know, the Olympic training center in dorms, you know, I was the alpha dog in the room. You know, I was the guy. I was the guy that ran the room, you know, like, and of course, Oscar was always a smaller weight class. You know, he was 125 and then 132. I was 147. And then moved up to 156 and won the nationals at that weight class. But, I don't dislike him, but, you know, I would love a fight with him. Why wouldn't I?
Right.
I always have.
Right.
I always have.
You could make a lot of improvements to the gym with the money you'd make from that fight.
I mean, honestly, yeah, you're right. No, it's not even about the money. It's just I love a challenge. And, of course, we know that fight, you know, would bring a lot, you know, money to Oscar, you know, because he is the golden boy and stuff. But since all, you know, you see Holyfield, Tyson, you see all these older guys coming back to fight each other. And I saw Fernando Vargas already challenging Oscar, you know, hey, let's do it. And I'm sure other people will be challenging him. And why would not? You know, it's a fight that could have happened years ago when he was looking for another title at 154, but it never happened. And I mean, I'm not saying we're fighting for another title, but hey, it would be fun. I would love that fight. I would love to do it.
So, so when Tyson fought Jones, they did it officially as an exhibition. Do you have in mind whether you'd rather do this as a real full on 3 minute rounds, 10 round fight, no headgear, or would you prefer to do
let's
it?
Go. No, I want to kick his butt. I really want to kick his ass. You know? Yeah, yeah. We don't need no sparring. We don't need big gloves. Let's do the real thing. You know, like put the small gloves on, and you know, hey, this boxing. You know, we don't need a sparring match.
Right. Well, what I've always said about when guys who are in your age range decide to come back, that I always prefer to see them at least fighting guys in that same age range than taking on the guy in his 20s, in his prime, or whatever. So if Oscar's going to come back, Raul Marquez sounds like a pretty good opponent to me.
I totally agree. I mean, that's what when he was talking about fighting Triple G and a lot of the young guys like Charlo, I mean, I'm like, this guy crazy, you know, I that didn't make sense to me. And of course, if like, you're right, you're absolutely right. If I was going to come back, I'm not even coming back. Look, I would come back to fight someone in my age category, you know, but not one of the young bucks. I mean, hey, that look, even sparring with Giovanni, moving around his angles, his speed, the way he is, I mean, it's hard to catch him. So imagine, you know, imagine somebody like Charlo, a top full-blown middleweight, super middleweight, like, you know, Canelo, that I'm telling you, I don't know where he gets those crazy ideas. He needs to find somebody his own, you know, in the same age category.
Yep.
Yeah, what do you think's going on? Why do you think he's so fixated and talking about it? Do you feel like he feels like maybe he left something on the field there, that he's got an itch to scratch?
Maybe he just misses the, you know, the attention. I don't understand. I really don't understand why he would come back and want to fight the Young Bucks. You know, that's another thing. Now, if you want to make some money and, you know, promote, I mean, look, all these YouTuber guys are making crazy money fighting each other.
Right.
And Oscar does have a name. I mean, he is the golden boy, and I respect that, you know, and, sure. and he's got to have the right partner to dance with. And that's me. That's me, guys. And if he wants to do it, I'm here.
Nice.
And he knows it too. You know, he knows it. But I mean, to go out there and, you know, take a chance. I mean, he's got kids, you know, he's got a family. I mean, he don't need to take a chance of getting hurt, you know, fighting some of the young guys. That's just my opinion. And I think, I mean, you guys would agree with me too. I mean, why would he fight some of the young lions? I think it's insane. I think it's crazy.
Right, yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. And I have it on good authority that he never misses an episode of the Showtime Boxing Podcast. Right. So he knows now that you're calling him out. He can't claim he doesn't know.
I love it.
There you go.
Oscar, let's go, baby. Let's go, right. Oscar De La Hoya. You know who the alpha dog was. You know who the real man is. You know who ran the show in the dorms back in the days. Oh, I got so many stories. Maybe if the fight happens, you know, I could, all those stories will come out. You know, I got a lot of good stories, you know, when we were in the Olympic training center in Colorado Springs. I mean, we used to spend 6-7 months out of the year training there when we traveled to different countries, you know, train there for 4 weeks, 5 weeks, and then we travel to different countries or even compete in different tournaments here in the state. So it would be an exciting press tour promotion, you know. Nice. And I would make it fun. I know I would.
It sounds like you've still got the smack. It sounds like you've still got the smack talking chops there. Like that.
I've always been some kind of a smack talking type of guy, but not a little bit more reserved. You know, some guys really come out and start all the more. Does this sound right? Educated smack? Is that better? Yeah. Like an educated?
Okay. There you go. Okay.
Yeah, and I, you know, all the cussing and all that. I'm not into that. But you know, just, you know, educated smack that really. Things that are true, that are facts, you know, everything I would be saying would be true.
Nice. El Diamante and El Nino de Oro, and we'll have the
Muy bien.
We'll have the tour on the Showtime Boxing Podcast. So there you go. Yes. How about that? Something to look forward to. But until then, all the very best for Giovanni, and you know, do come back
Thank you, guys.
Let us know how everything goes. We'll be following his progress, and all the best. And go off, and while you're in Louisiana, enjoy yourself some Cajun food, and we'll talk to you soon, my friend.
Thank you, guys. Thank you for having me on.
Thanks for joining us, Raul.
All right. Let's move on from some speculative in-ring action featuring our podcast guests to some actual fights. As we noted at the top of the show, not a lot to look back on, but there were a couple of cards of some significance. On Thursday from San Juan, Puerto Rico on Ring City, USA, Amanda Serrano showed once again why she is universally acknowledged as one of the very best, if not the best, female boxer pound for pound, with an impressive ninth round stoppage of Daniela Bermudez. Two quick body shots caused Bermudez to turn her back, walk away, and drop to her knees for the count. And on Saturday, from the boxing hotspot of Gibraltar, Dylan White gained revenge for his stoppage loss to Alexander Povetkin last year, scoring a knockout after four dominant rounds, during which Povetkin, whether due to age or possibly his recent bout with COVID, simply never looked right. Eric, your thoughts about either or both of those?
Well, I'm walking around with heavier pockets today after betting on White to win by knockout, and rarely have I had less sweating to do over a boxing bet. Yeah, from the opening bell, almost every sign pointed to Povetkin getting stopped. I think, unfortunately, I'm pinning the loss more on Povetkin being washy than on anything spectacular White did. It's a shame. I mean, White fought well. He used his jab brilliantly, showed off his power in both hands. But the big takeaway for me was that Povetkin, who didn't really have it anymore the first time they fought, right, but landed one perfect punch, just doesn't have it anymore. He isn't pulling the trigger as quickly as he used to. He was marking up and swelling up easily. His punch resistance isn't what it used to be. He's 41 years old. I really hope he retires. He had a very good career for a little while there, was possibly the second best heavyweight in the world. Hopefully he can be satisfied with that. And White, meanwhile, gets back to where he was going into the first fight. He's somewhere around the number six or so heavyweight. He's in his prime at 32 years old. He fits in nicely with just about any heavyweight opponent, and the British heavyweight scene has rarely been hotter. So
yeah,
he needed this win. He got it emphatically. He has some good earning years ahead of him, I think. As for Serrano, she looked great. She's that rare women's boxer who consistently scores knockouts working in 2-minute rounds. Bermudez was a very good opponent, and while the rounds were competitive, the fight wasn't close. And I don't know if there's ever been a more compelling women's pound-for-pound debate than what we have right now. You can make a case for Serrano. You can make a case for Clarissa Shields. You can make a case for Katie Taylor. And I really don't think any of the three cases is clearly stronger or weaker than any of the others. And if they're smart and their promoters are smart, they'll work with that and hype up every fight for any of the three of them as a point of comparison as they each try to prove they're the best right now.
Yeah, Povetkin, he just looked kind of shot from the beginning, didn't he? And I sort of made a similar note to you in that outside of that terrific left uppercut that ended things in the first fight, this, in a sense, was just that first fight turned up to 11, and that Povetkin had more months of aging to add on, and White came into this with a greater focus and determination to right that wrong, if you will. At the same time, we have talked briefly in the past about how COVID can have lingering effects, and apparently Povetkin's COVID infection was so bad that, you know, he had to put off the fight, the rematch, not once but twice.
Right.
And it is asking a lot. We still don't know a lot about it, and it is asking an awful lot for somebody to perform as an elite athlete after that, particularly when they're over 40, particularly when they seem to be on the downside anyway. Mm-hmm. I agree with you. I do hope he retires. He doesn't look like he has anything left there. It's been an interesting and, I don't know, a bit of a strange career on some levels, I think, Povetkin's. You know, I remember when he beat Chris Bird, I thought, wow, this guy's going to be a monster at the top of the heavyweight division. And I don't know that he ever really, truly recovered from hiring to Eddie Atlas.
I was just going to say that's sort of the thing that slowed his ascent, maybe even derailed it to some extent.
A little bit, right? Because Teddy did what Teddy does. And the first thing he did was just try to destroy his confidence to tell him he needed to build him up. And I'm not sure he ever quite recovered. And then, of course, there were the drug suspensions and so on. Big credit to White for just turning off the switch and becoming immediately gracious afterward. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure why it was beyond the ability of Povetkin's corner to provide their own stool, but White walked over to his corner, grabbed a stool, and carried it over. And just instantly, it was almost as if White knew during the fight, and I'm sure he did. He knew better than the rest of us that Povetkin wasn't right during that fight, because he just instantly turned into a really gracious opponent, and good credit to him for that. And yeah, Serrano, I'm a big fan, have been for a time, and I made the same note as you. Any female fighter who can score that many KOs is either only fighting absolute scrubs or is a first-rate fighter, and Serrano's a first-rate fighter. I'm a little worried that she might not get the big fight that she deserves. There had been talk for some time, and it nearly got made, the idea of her moving up to meet Katie Taylor. Mm-hmm. But I would guess the money now is on Taylor herself moving up to fight Jessica McCaskill, which might leave Serrano in the cold a little bit, at least for a while. But she's a really fabulous fighter, Amanda Serrano.
Yeah, she is. All right, so that's two fight reviews. Just two fights to preview this week as well. In Dubai, Carl Frampton and Jamel Herring finally meet for their oft-delayed junior lightweight clash, while in Uzbekistan, Murodjon Akhmadaliyev returns to the ring for the first time in 15 months to defend the 122-pound belts he took from Daniel Roman last time out. He meets Ryosuke Iwasa. Kieran, what are your hopes and expectations from these two bouts?
I'm not entirely sure what to expect from Herring Frampton anymore, to be honest with you. A few years ago, I'd have made Frampton a pretty big favorite, but over the last couple of years, you know, Herring's the one who's put up, you know, the better performances against better opposition. Frampton seems to have at best plateaued, and I think it's probably on the downslope. And then you add to that, you know, you've got this recent history of hand problems that Frampton has had, exacerbated by the apparent accident that he had in that hotel lobby. Right. And even this rematch was already scheduled to have happened, but was delayed for a little bit more to allow Frampton's hands to recover. So you wonder about that and how much of a factor that's going to be. And Frampton's been talking already about the fact that if he doesn't win this fight, he'll retire. And once you have fighters starting to talk about retiring, you know, that often sort of tends to be, you know, a self-reinforcing prediction a little bit. Owasa, I think, is a good opponent for Akhmad Aliyev. He's a former titleist. He's only had a few losses, two of them to TJ Doheny and early in his career to Shinsuke Yamanaka, eminently forgivable. But he also had a loss to Lee Haskins in there. And Haskins, apart from the fact that he's from Bristol, England, which makes him inherently a fine person, you know, he's not the kind of fighter to whom you should be losing if you really want to make an impression on Akhmad Aliyev. So I think, you know, add to that the fact that the fight is taking place in Tashkent, and I fully expect the MJ train to keep on rolling after that fight.
Yeah, I'm looking ahead at this weekend. It's a little like the weekend we just had, that bit of a slowish weekend for the sport of boxing. These are both good, solid fights where the winner is not predetermined, but where I can't quite get excited. You know, these are both that one notch below me trying to carve out time to be able to watch either of these fights live. Akhmad Aliyev is certainly the highest upside guy of the four that are on display, so I'm probably slightly more interested in his fight, although it does appear Owasa is a clear underdog there. I'd still very much like to see an Akhmad Aliyev Danny Roman rematch. Maybe this leads to that. But yeah, Frampton Herring with Frampton 34 and Herring 35 feels like a loser leaves town match. If either guy loses decisively, I think his time in the top 10 is done. As you said, Frampton is saying that if he loses decisively, he intends to possibly walk away. But it's a very even fight on paper and at the sports books. I'm seeing Frampton listed as a tiny minus 136 favorite. Herring is the tiny plus 108 underdog. So pretty close to even money. Good, solid fight. Clearly a must win for both guys.
Yeah, indeed. The main event of our new segment also features some upcoming bouts. Not yet set in stone, but certainly something potentially to be excited about. One of the sports sanctioning bodies has effectively ordered a four-man tournament to crown an undisputed lord of the superflies, with Trisaketsu Rungvisai taking on Carlos Quadras and Juan Francisco Estrada and Roman Gonzalez facing off in a rubber match with the winners to then meet. Eric, we talked last week about whether it's fair to say or not that the top fighters today don't face each other. And you specifically mentioned the Chocolatito Estrada Sorongvisai Quadras round robin as a counterpoint to that accusation. So the fact that this is sort of being mandated to take place, is this one of those rare occasions where we actually have to take a slug of whiskey or something and grit our teeth and actually give an alphabet body some props?
No, absolutely not. No props, no whiskey, no need to grit teeth. This calls to mind the very famous Chris Rock bit. I take care of my kids. You're supposed to take care of your kids. It's that. It shows how pathetic the alphabets typically are, that anyone would congratulate them or thank them for telling the best fighters in the division to fight each other. You know, remove the alphabets from the equation, and some version of this tournament was happening next anyway. This is how these guys can make good money, fighting each other. Is it possible that if the alphabet doesn't pull its franchise champion shenanigans so it can order this exact combination of bouts, that they mix and match differently? Yeah, Sri Saket was wanting to jump in and face Estrada for a third time, so maybe that happens instead. And guess what? That's a great fight. Their first two fights were both outstanding, so it wouldn't have been a big loss if we'd gotten that instead. But instead, we are apparently probably getting Estrada Chocolatito 3, and you can't go wrong with that, certainly. And then we get Sri Saket against Quadras, which is significant because it completes the round robin. That's the only pairing we haven't seen yet, and boy, does Quadras need a win. He's 0-3 with three tough competitive losses against great fighters in this round robin so far. So, yeah, this tournament is great, assuming it happens as planned. Let's celebrate it, but let's do so without making the Alphabet Group a big part of the story. You know, congratulations, Alphabet Group. You told four fighters who never shy away from a challenge, and who can only make money fighting each other to fight each other. Congratulations on not screwing it up by inserting an unworthy mandatory challenger into the mix. Is that where we are? If so, then well done. Take a victory lap.
Yeah, exactly. And what does it say about them and their rules and the way it's structured that, in their mind, the only way to make this happen is to take the guy who's the champion and not make him champion anymore and elevate him to some other fantasy level so that anyway. And I should put the word yet in where you said they congratulations for not screwing it up.
Right. Right. There's plenty of time.
The year
to screw
is
something
young,
up.
My friends.
Yes. Yep. Okay, there's a lot to cover in our news undercard, good and bad. You and I have frequently expressed our hope that Gervonta Tank Davis can overcome his occasionally self-destructive tendencies and maximize his potential in the ring. That hope took a bit of a knock with the news last week that he has been charged with 14 counts following a November hit-and-run accident that left four people injured. Jail time is on the table. That may or may not happen, but either way, this gets the Marvin Hagler very bad when you read all the details of what Davis is accused of. In other news, it has been announced that former junior middleweight titleist Tony Harrison will be facing Bryant Perrella on Fox on April 17th in Los Angeles, Harrison's first bout since the death of his father from COVID last April. Also confirmed, Andy Ruiz Jr. versus Chris Areola on May 1st from Dignity Health Park in Carson, California on Fox pay-per-view. Arislandi Lara will return on the free TV portion of the undercard against Thomas Cornflake LaManna for a 154-pound belt. Also announced, and you and I are both thrilled about this, I know, is the first Bridgerweight title fight, which is a rematch between Bryant Jennings and Oscar Rivas, a bout that Rivas won by 12th-round KO in January 2019. Apparently not happening after first not happening and then happening all within the span of the past week is the projected Mike Tyson Evander Holyfield exhibition, which, as an eagle-eyed listener advised us a few weeks back, had been penciled in for the Hard Rock Stadium in Miami on May 29th. Kieran, a whole lot of news items there, some of them more serious than others. Anything you want to weigh in on among those headlines?
So to pick the last one first, the Tyson Holyfield fight/non-fight/fight/non-fight. So apparently the two sides couldn't come to an agreement despite the kind of sums we're talking about, the purses being talked about, at least the total purse, somewhere in the region of $25 million. So apart from his exhibition against Roy Jones, Tyson hasn't fought since 2005. Holyfield hasn't fought since 2011. And they're holding out for more money for an exhibition because $25 million isn't enough. Which brings us to my tweet of the week.
Ah, okay.
From our friend Sergio Mora, who wrote simply, and he posted this right after the Oscar De La Hoya news that we talked about earlier, quote, "What a time to be a legend past his prime." And he is not wrong. It's a glorious, glorious day to be a long retired but well-known fighter.
Yeah. Now I didn't even notice that tweet, but so there was no further context. So we don't know whether Sergio was possibly trying to loop himself in. I mean, I think he knows he's not quite a legend, but yeah. Is it possible he was trying to suggest something about as long as all these legends are making money?
I don't think so. There wasn't any further follow-up or anything. I think he posted something about, like, he retweeted something about one tweet about the Oscars making his mic drop announcement and then just followed it up. I interpreted it more on the, you know, sort of 1950s dad sitting at the breakfast table reading the newspaper while smoking his pipe and seeing a news item and going, I tell you, son, it's a hell of a time to be a legendary fighter past his prime. So yeah,
he's right. I mean, that, you know, what the numbers that Tyson Jones did just opened the door for all sorts of stuff, and it does kind of blow my mind that not that Tyson might try to hold out for more money, because, you know, he's just been through all this. He made a bunch of money against Jones. As far as we know, he's in okay shape these days financially, but I feel like Holyfield, if you're getting a multi-million dollar offer with the financial issues that we've heard he's had since the end of his boxing career, I don't know where you're going to make more money than this for one training camp and one night's work.
Seriously. As for the rest of the news, let's do all the serious stuff. The Gervonta story. Gervonta does keep failing to show the maturity we hope he's finally going to show. I mean, this wasn't his only incident last year, of course. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you mentioned the details of the incident, and if folks haven't seen it, the basic summary is, you know, it's not good at all. He was identified as the driver of a Lamborghini that went through a red light, struck another car, went into the fence of a convenience store, and then he allegedly abandoned the car and took off. A Toyota Corolla pulled up. He jumped into that and took off. Not one element of this shows any kind of good judgment or maturity. No. I mean, apart from going through a red light, apart from hitting somebody else. I mean, do you think that no one's going to notice a Lamborghini stuck in the fence of a convenience store and no one's going to figure out, like, from the plates who it is, who left it there? As you noted when we were texting about this, you talked about, you know, some of the prison time. You know, plenty of folks wrote that the charges carry a possible combined penalty of 7 years in jail. But as you noted when we were talking about it, any sentences are likely to run concurrently, not consecutively. And we're looking at months, not years, if he does go to jail. But the behavior that has put him in this place was poor. And we keep hoping that Gervonta is going to get it together. And there are months where he looks like he's doing it, and then he pulls this off. So let us hope this is the last one that this sort of scares him straight.
Yeah.
And then finally, on a lighter note, I truly cannot think of a more appropriate advertisement for the Bridgerweight division than that its inaugural title fight is between a guy who hasn't won since 2018 and a guy who, until the other week, hadn't won since he beat that same guy back in 2019. Oh, Alphabet Buddies, we began this segment hinting that maybe, just maybe, it was time to give you some credit, but you just keep on being you.
Yeah, I'd have to listen back to when we first talked about Bridgerweight, but I think that Bryant Jennings was the name that I threw out there as the type of fighter who might fight for a Bridgerweight title, mm-hmm. because all of the actual top 30 or so heavyweights and cruiserweights wouldn't have any interest. That's where we're headed. It's living right down to all of our expectations.
Indeed. And don't get me wrong, I love Bryant Jennings. As I have expressed before, not only is he a great interview and a great guy to talk to, but ever since that time that Brian Campbell and I got stuck in an elevator with him in New York City, we'd be tight. Love me some Bryant Jennings, but still.
Yeah. Yeah, that was a career high point for him, really, I think. Stuck in
the for him, certainly, yes.
Yes. All right, we conclude the show now with me assigning Kieran his homework. Mulvaney has to make a top five list next week. Professor Raskin will determine the topic. I think this is a fun one, but I can't take full credit for it. The credit primarily goes to one of our listeners who emailed me, Sam Rose. I'm polishing it up a little bit and putting some parameters on it, but the root idea is all Sam's. Here it is, Kieran. Next week, you will present to the world the all-time top five beat-the-count moments, which is to say, the five greatest getting knocked down and getting off the deck moments. Insert Chumbawamba music here. Here are the parameters. Obviously, we're looking at big knockdowns here, where a punch landed that looked like it could have or should have finished the fight, but the fighter got up and fought on. And here's the parameter I'm adding, although it's an obvious one, I think. He has to have fought on and fought back. So, for example, here's one that doesn't qualify. Fernando Montiel versus Nonito Donaire. I don't know how in the hell Montiel beat that count after taking that knockdown, but he did, and the fight was allowed to continue, and Nonito ran across the ring and landed two more punches, and the ref stopped it. So getting off the deck didn't count for much. Montiel didn't get out of the round, so it doesn't qualify for the list. The fighter who is knocked down doesn't have to come back and win the fight to qualify for this list, although it's certainly good if he does come back and win the fight. He just has to improbably get up and fight back or survive the round. Got it? Makes sense? Any questions on that?
That makes total sense. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, so by the same nature,
Curtis Stevens somehow peeling himself off the canvas against Gennady Golovkin doesn't count, because even though he made it out of the round, he still got the snot beaten out of him, for example.
Right. That's another one that, yeah, doesn't, you have to, you know, you don't have to come back and win the fight, but you have to come back and do a little
compete.
Something. Yes.
Right.
Yeah. If it gotcha. Basically, all credit for getting up from a knockdown that looked like it was going to end it. But right. if there was no reversal of fortune whatsoever that followed, it doesn't quite qualify for this all-time greatest beat the count moments.
Okay, I like this. This is a bit of a challenging one. It's fun. I can think of a couple already.
Yep.
one that pops to mind actually involves a guest we had, a Hall of Fame guest, who wasn't one of the fighters, if you know what I mean. But I think you'll figure it out. And then there's another very obvious one. But yeah, this is actually going to have to require some thinking. I like that.
Perhaps. Although, of course, the listeners, you guys can always help out. Tweet ideas at Kieran. Make it easier for him. Make him do a little less thinking if you have any ideas that are coming to mind.
Yes, I'm all about that, actually. Strong engagement. No, that's a fun one. And thanks very much to Sam for suggesting that one. So, that is good. All right. That will do it for this week's edition of Showtime Boxing with Raskin and Mulvaney. Many thanks again to Raul Marquez for joining us and for getting the clock running on his challenge of Oscar De La Hoya. We will be back next week with a full breakdown of the April 10th Showtime Championship Boxing triple header, headlined by Boots Ennis taking on Sergei Lipinets. Until then, thanks for listening. Be safe, be kind, and be well.
Docuseries on Paramount Plus.
Why did he kill his family? The answer lies across the ocean in a woman named Sylvie.
She's a CAN model.
Where desire leads to deception.
I ended up spending $12,000 and $15,000 a day.
It was addictive.
I can't get you out.
And obsession leads to murder.
Who did this to your family?
You can't really maintain a fantasy forever.
Control Alt Desire. Now streaming on Paramount Plus.